From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Leiden. On this episode, the future of fuel may not be as sci-fi as you think.
Electricity is the most likely out of all of the alternative fuels, I think, to be the next fuel for the consumer.
We check in with the most likely candidates for our growing fuel needs, and I take a ride around Washington, D.C. in an electric car. And if alternative fuel reduces global warming, that'll be good news for Tadia Isengset. The Norwegian musician plays instruments carved out of ice from frozen northern lakes and glaciers. Then author Herbrand Bakker, his novel, Ten White Geese, is about the search for solitude.
For a writer these days, it's horrible. Cell phones are horrible.
And after that, we check in on the fading ancient language of Aramaic. While many languages around the world are extinct or threatened, Aramaic was once as prevalent as English is today.
It was also the language of Jesus, and that matters for, I think, human culture, human heritage.
Plus, Johnny Marr of the 80s British rock band The Smiths, and in case you thought they were headed for a reunion...
Some people are nice enough to hope that there will be some big happy ending. Well, the fact is, there is a happy ending. I'm happy.
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. Stay tuned. It's a good show. With gas prices headed into the stratosphere, there's a race to produce a low-cost alternative. That's our cover story, Fuel Fight. Here's the top three contenders.
Well, the top three technologies, you can kind of divide them into broad categories. There are the biofuels. This is fuel made from organic matter. There are the natural gas and propane fuels. And then there's electricity.
That's Jonathan Strickland, writer for How Stuff Works. Okay, this isn't the Oscars and we don't want to tip our hand, but in the 60s, in the Jetsons TV series, cars noiselessly flew. Gradually, today's electric cars are replacing the family station wagon.
I live in the suburbs, so I use the car to take my kids around, take the kids to school every day. I have three kids, and I put them in the back, take them to school. Then I commute to work and do some errands once in a while. Kind of typical driving. Maybe I put about 30 or 40 miles a day on it.
That's Duran Shalvey. He's a dad, husband, and electrical engineer. In 2008, his gas car died. Pump prices soared, and he was already an electric car devotee.
I commuted to work on an electric motorcycle for about 3 years. And then a couple of years ago, the electric vehicles became available in this area. So I purchased an electric vehicle.
Now he drives a Nissan Leaf. Yes, a Leaf, get it? Environmentally friendly, no gas tank. Now, you wouldn't drive up I-95 to New York in it, but at about 80 miles to a charge, Duran had no problem getting from the burbs to our downtown studios.
Fasten your seatbelt, we're ready to go. Okay.
All right.
It has a little melody when it turns on, which you can disable, but I left it on. I think my wife likes it, so it's...
We're in a brave new world.
So the car is now on.
Duran just plugs the Leaf in every night, like a cell phone. In fact, when we got back from our drive, his video screen indicated where the charging places are, including one in the NPR garage.
Electricity is the most likely out of all of the alternative fuels, I think, to be the next fuel for the consumer.
Jonathan Strickland of How Stuff Works, he says electricity has an added bonus. It's green.
The environmental impact is really, well, it's negligible if you're talking about the driver. Of course, you have to look at the other side of that equation for environmental impact because it all depends on how the electricity is generated.
You have a report card on how these alternate fuels actually perform. So let's hear your criteria.
Okay. I was looking at fuels and judging them based upon how much they would cost, the environmental impact of that alternative fuel. How soon could we expect to have this sort of alternative fuel as an actual option? And finally, then there's how likely is it that this will be the new fuel of the future, you know, if we project out a decade or so? I started to judge these on a 1 to 5 scale, 1 being the bad end and 5 being the great end. So a 5 would be very cheap. I gave biodiesel a 3 because you usually have to blend that with diesel to make a useful fuel. But for environmental impact, I gave it a 4 out of 5. It's much cleaner than gasoline is. As far as how soon, I gave that a 2 out of 5. And The reason is I think this is really something we'll see used perhaps more in commercial use, industrial use, less so for us, the average driver.
If biodiesel is actually not so great and electricity actually could be pretty good, what about something in the middle like natural gas?
Natural gas is, it's got a lot of potential. I mean, we're already using it in a lot of municipalities. The bus system here in Atlanta, Georgia, where I live, a lot of the buses run on natural gas. It's very good as far as a fuel goes. There are some big concerns. One, natural gas is essentially methane. And methane is a greenhouse gas. In fact, it's a greenhouse gas that has 20 times the impact of carbon dioxide. And I don't think it's likely that we're going to see natural gas being used in consumer vehicles, but I do think it's highly likely we'll see natural gas used in industrial vehicles.
But Strickland says there are big barriers against making electricity a real competitor with gasoline.
All of these different avenues have their advantages and disadvantages, and they all have different challenges. But scalability is a challenge across every single one of these alternative fuels because we don't have anything that can meet the same supply that our gasoline has right now.
So how to do it? How to make the switch from gas stations to charging stations? Adele Morris is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. She says the federal government already has some ideas.
Everything from tax credits to mandates for certain kinds of liquid transportation fuels to programs in which the federal government agencies buy alternative fuels for their own purposes.
In her work, she asks the question, when the government throws money at the fuel market, does it fix the problem?
We looked at these arguments and tried to look at them through the lens of an economist. Do they make economic sense? For example, on the environmental objective, certainly we are concerned about greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuels. But we argue that the best way to address that would be to put a price on carbon, for example, through a carbon tax, rather than try to subsidize alternatives. It's much less efficient.
And why do you think that might be a better way to go than subsidize through taxpayer money, creating a green fuel?
For one thing, whenever you subsidize something, you pay people to do things they were going to do anyway. And then, depending on the design of the program, you can actually create peculiar incentives. For example, if you set a standard, well, then people don't have any incentive to develop technology that surpasses that standard. And they may even not want to do that because then you'll just tighten the standard later.
So if the government isn't significant enough to make a difference in startups on something like alternative transportation fuel, we talked about what you do think could work, you know, strengthening carbon cap and trade. What else?
Well, I think certainly there's an important role for government in research. Basic research is going to be underprovided by private industry. I think, though, without a price on carbon, it's going to be tough for any of these technologies to really find a market because they're competing against technologies that can pollute the environment for free.
And you'll remember Duron Chavez, Nissan Leaf. Morris says if the government really wants to move away from gas-powered cars, it better change the way it subsidizes electric cars, because there's a twist.
We have a tax credit for the purchase of plug-in electric cars. It ranges up to about $7,500 per electric vehicle. But it doesn't mean that we'd necessarily get any environmental benefits, because the way the rules work, electric vehicle manufacturers can sell credits to other automakers towards their fuel economy standards. So that means that other automakers can sell more polluting cars for every electric car that's sold.
But let's look beyond electricity, beyond today, to the alternative fuels of the future.
Plasma gasification. You have said two of my favorite words of all time.
Here's a short story about plasma gasification. For decades, Luz Cercio has been working on it because back in the 1970s, a former NASA engineer buddy came to his door.
He showed up at my house one day and says, I'm going to turn garbage into electricity using plasma, and I want you to help me.
So So Lou Cercio helped, and together they designed the alternative fuel of the future. The plasma torch they designed makes a stream of super hot gas.
The type of plasma that we use is a form of artificial lightning.
Jonathan Strickland explains more.
All right, to explain the process, you get a plasma torch. This burns at an incredible temperature. We're talking on the level of the surface of the sun. That's how hot it gets. The idea is you could take in garbage, use a plasma torch on it. Anything that's carbon-based, anything that's organic, gasifies. That gas can then be scrubbed and turned into fuel. And then anything inorganic turns into inert slag. It looks a lot like volcanic rock.
But John, if never mind grass into gas, if I can turn my garbage into gas, then, you know, why isn't everyone being given a T-shirt to promote this? Why are we not seeing this everywhere we go? And a tote bag, I might add.
You know, I ask myself the same question because I've watched video footage of the first of these plasma waste converters. That the video footage dated from the early 80s. Paying for it is tricky. It's going to require more investment than what the government is capable of making, however. It's going to take investment on behalf of private companies because we're talking huge, huge investments.
Put a man on the moon in 1969. Maybe the best thing the government can do is put someone from Keokuk, Iowa, into Carson City, Nevada, on a terrestrial, low-cost, totally harmless energy design for the automobile. It's been a chilly week in Washington, D.C., but for Tadia Isengset, it's the perfect temperature. The Norwegian musician carves blocks of ice into musical instruments. We caught up with him at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. last night, where, dressed in a furry jacket and mittens, he improvised on a sparkling set of ice chimes, drums, and horns. He played, well, until they melted away.
My name is Tadia Isengset, and I come from Norway. Well, this started in 1999, I think, and I was asked to compose a piece to be held in a frozen waterfall, and I found it so beautifully that I kind of fell in love with it immediately. Being a nice musician is a little bit difficult, because every time when I go to a concert, I have a new instrument. Ice cellos, ice guitars, ice harps, ice fiddle, anything. You know, this year we had on tubas. So, and tubas is kind of a tuba. Quite often I don't actually know how my instrument will sound. So I just have to listen to the sound that is being created and try to create music out of these sounds. If you work like this, then you suddenly can be led into something else, some other kind of music that you did not think of, that you did not plan. It's like you find a new flower, maybe, a new color. We've been experimenting on ice instruments now for 12, 13 years, but still, I go back to where it all started, with one little cube of ice and trying to get it to sound. The artificial ice doesn't have any sound at all, nearly. So we have to try to find lake ice. But when you come to lake ice, there is only some lakes that have sound. And even if you find a lake, there might be just a few pieces that will have a good sound. Of course, you have the very crispy sounds that you will have when you walk on crushed ice or snow. But you also have the really low frequency sounds. But I think my favorite is if I get a little piece of ice to sing long, like a long-lasting tone. when eyes can make a tone that lasts for 10 seconds, I nearly start crying. I think it's so beautiful. I would say it sounds surprisingly warm.
Ice musician Tarja Isingset. A mysterious Dutch woman, humiliated by an affair with a student, turns up on a remote Welsh farm. She answers to the name Emily, but that's actually the first name of the American poet about whom she's writing her PhD. Her husband has no idea where she is. This is the opening of Herbrand Bakker's new international bestseller called 10 White Geese.
She's trying to make the best of it, and she tries to be alone, but as you and I and everybody knows, it is virtually impossible to be alone in these times.
The search for solitude is just one theme in this mysterious and often menacing story. The woman is haunted by the memory of who she once was, and the farm seems to be giving her a chance at reclaiming her health and strength. Then, all around her, things start to happen in the natural world that remind her of her own mortality. The white geese who live on her farm begin to disappear, one by one, and she can't save them. And then one day, something breaks the woman's solitude.
One day, a young boy, 18, 19 years old, jumps over her garden fence, and he is together with his dog, Sam. And I always like animals in books. Animals are very important to me, as a character as well. And this boy, he doesn't really say who he is. And he is very double-sided, you know. You could say that he's an angel of death, but you could also say that he's an angel of love or whatever. And they develop like a sort of love-hate relationship. And then the husband finally finds out where she is, and he and a policeman he befriends board a ferry to Hull on the day before Christmas, and they get closer and closer.
I love what you said a moment ago about it's really hard to be alone, because she's really trying, and it gets increasingly noisy, if you will, around the farm. And there's something about the fact, though, that you have here a protagonist, a heroine, if you will. She doesn't have email. She's left her cell phone on the ferry. Nobody else has a cell phone. And it's so quiet.
I don't know if a lot of people realize this, but, you know, for a writer these days, it's horrible. Cell phones are horrible for us, because the thing is, people know things about each other all the time, you know, by WhatsApping, by sending text messages, by Facebook, by Twitter. It is more and more impossible to, you know, not know things about other people. And a lot of, you know, plot-driven books, and especially thrillers, are based upon people not knowing things. So I find it a curse, you know, these cell phones. Because you always have to, like, for instance, in this book, I had to, at a certain point, think of, you know, where she would have lost or left her cell phone. It's horrible. In that sense, you know, I wished I was a novelist maybe 50 or 80 years ago.
It's a beautiful book, Herbrand, and you've set it in this moody landscape. But let's get down to your character. Who is the woman who calls herself Emily?
She's a woman that teaches, or maybe you had better say taught, at the University of Amsterdam. And she is, or was, working on a thesis about Emily Dickinson.
The first thing that happens is she gets bitten by a badger.
Yeah, that's strange, yeah, and nobody believes her. She goes to the general practitioner in the little town, and he doesn't believe her. Nobody believes her. And I think that's something that's in all the characters in the book. Everybody is maybe, or maybe not, lying.
Well, let's take a look at the poem that is beside her bedside. Sometimes she doesn't write much while she's at this remote farmhouse, but she is a Dickinson scholar, and you have one poem here. I love it. I had not read this poem. Could you read it for us?
Emple, make this bed with awe. in it wait till judgment break, excellent and fair. Be its mattress straight, be its pillow round. Let no sunrise yellow noise interrupt this ground. That's it. You know, it's a very short but mysterious poem. I think maybe it is really one of the reasons for me to write this book, to try to really understand, to really feel this poem.
When you think about this poem today and think about the theme of mortality, which exists in this novel, I was just sort of adding it up in 10 White Geese. Emily Dickinson, of course, is dead, although the conversation keeps going on with her. At one point, Emily, our character, says to her, "It's easy for you. Life is easy for you because you're dead." The cottage has been rented from a woman who is dead and whose presence she senses. The doctor she goes to see is smoking himself to death. You play with this whole idea here of, what if I wasn't here? What if I just dropped out of existence right now and ran away and joined the circus, but there's no circus?
That's a very relaxing thought, right? Tempting. What I realize now is that in the time that I was writing this book, I was building up to a huge depression without realizing it. Even when I was in the middle of this depression, I did not know what was happening to me. I had angst, the angst with a capital A, fear. It was horrible. And I think this is also, you know, in the book, it's almost like a sort of exorcism of, you know, things I was feeling and experiencing at that time, 2009, 2010, that I was trying to get rid of.
Was it difficult to write in the voice of Emily? Was it difficult to be this woman and this sort of middle-aged woman here?
No, not at all. I am a strange man, maybe. But I think that there is no fundamental difference between men and women. A lot of people would say otherwise, perhaps. But there were certain physical things that I had some problems with. But, you know, my mother is still alive. I have friends, girlfriends. My sister was very helpful. And that's something you can ask them. But I don't really think there is such a big difference between men and women.
Herr Ron Bakker joined us from Amsterdam. Thank you so much.
You're very, very welcome.
From the early 19th century to as recently as 1996, thousands of women and girls were incarcerated in church-run laundries in harsh, abusive conditions without pay. The Magdalen laundries were a virtual prison for unwed mothers, industrial school dropouts, and orphans. Survivors had campaigned for decades for an official state apology. Finally, this past Tuesday, in a televised speech before the Irish Parliament, Prime Minister Enda Kenny did just that.
For many years, we failed you. We forgot you, or if we thought of you at all, we did so in untrue and offensive stereotypes. This is a national shame, for which I say again, I'm deeply sorry and offer my full and heartfelt apologies.
Joining us now to discuss the apology is Mary Steed. She's the committee director of the advocacy group Justice for the Magdalens, and her mother was one of the women who worked in the Magdalen laundries in the 1960s in Ireland. Mary Steed, thank you very much. You're joining us from WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jackie.
So please tell us your mother's story in Ireland.
Well, my mother, like many other children in Ireland, was born at a time of Catholic Church repression in the early 1930s, and she was born out of wedlock. She was placed in an industrial school. But at the age of 14, I believe, from what we understand, her mother tried to take her out, and there was some sort of a row with the nuns, and their answer to keep her away from her mother was to simply send her to the Magdalen Laundry at Sunday's Well in Cork. And this was in 1947. She spent the next 10 years there doing sewing for them, anything from embroidery to smock dresses, items for the clergy, altar and surplices, that sort of thing. And obviously, there was profit being made on these items, but she was never paid for that.
So she's there from about the time she's 14 to her mid-20s, and she can't leave?
Correct. They actually did let her out in 1957 with a work referral. But having been raised completely by the nuns, she exited with absolutely no world skills. So within a year and a half, she found herself pregnant with me. and then was sent to one of the mother and baby homes run by another religious order and remained there with me until my adoption to the United States was organized. She left and eventually ended up in Wales.
So your group has worked for years to get the Irish state to recognize the injustice, the harshness, the abuse that went on in these institutions. What was your reaction to Prime Minister Enda Kenny's speech?
It was very emotional for me. I kind of got teary just listening to your clip of it again. To get an apology was exceedingly meaningful for me, for my mother, for many of the women that suffered with this notion that they were fallen or somehow damaged.
And is your mother still alive?
She is, yes. She lives in the UK.
What was her reaction?
It was very meaningful to her. I know, you know, it's been a very difficult period of her life to talk about, and she still has great difficulty with it, even with me. But I think she recognizes the importance of that weight coming off her shoulders. I think it's freed her up considerably to talk about her past. That's going to be the case for a lot of women.
There's been a lot of stigma over the years against the girls who were in the Magdalen laundries. And now, along with this apology, the Irish Prime Minister has said that there will be a compensation package given to these women. Is this enough, do you think?
No. At the moment, we're kind of frightened because it's not looking like what we had envisioned. But, you know, it remains to be seen.
What do you envision? What would be better?
Well, we looked at a multi-prong approach and tried to base it on things like length of time there, what abuse they might have suffered, what were the lifelong repercussions of that, and using a scale to determine what each woman was entitled to. So sort of an individual approach rather than a one-size-fits-all scheme.
And how many women are alive today, do you think, who've passed through the Magdalen laundries?
We're looking at anywhere from 800 to 1,200 women. Now, we may end up with a few more that come out of the woodwork or that might not have been correctly recorded, but at most, perhaps 2,000 women.
So I would just like to ask you, Mary Steed, how old your mom is today and what her life is like now.
Well, she's approaching 80 years old. And, you know, I guess in comparison to other women that I've met who really, really suffered, she came out of it fairly decently. She married, but she was too frightened to have more children. And this is a theme that we found very common with mothers of loss, this notion of secondary infertility, that they're just too afraid that that child might be snatched either by the religious or by God, you know, through death. And then her inability to come to terms with the family that she had lost. She has a brother who wanted very much to reunite with her, and I found him. But at first she denied him. She sort of felt like I was the one that got sent off to the industrial school while he was raised in family. So those were painful aspects of her life and things that she still has grave difficulty coming to terms with.
Mary Steed is the daughter of a survivor of the Magdalen laundries in Ireland, and she's the committee director of Justice for the Magdalens, an advocacy group. Mary, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Jackie.
These young people, learning their communion prayers, are singing in Aramaic, the language of Christ. They're singing in a church in Zako, Iraq, a city on the Turkish border. Aramaic today is mostly spoken in small villages across northern Iraq, Syria, southern Turkey, and it's a haunting experience to hear it in remote places. I first encountered it with Isho Joseph, once a former translator for the Iraqi regime, who is from Zako and who grew up speaking Aramaic.
This language, I mean, all languages are important, obviously, for their speakers. But this language specifically has its historical importance. It was language of great empires, lingua franca of the entire Middle East for once. And now it has, you know, dying. It is really painful. And it was also the language of Jesus, and that matters for, I think, human culture, human heritage. It is one of the old, you know, languages that I think should something should be done to preserve it.
This month, writer Ariel Sabar has a piece in February, Smithsonian Magazine, about attempts to do exactly that, to preserve what many say is a dying language. It's astonishing to think that it could be, he says. It was once as common as English, spoken by Jews, Christians, Zoroastrians. At its height, Aramaic could be heard from the Mediterranean to the borders of China. Now, it may be one or two generations away from vanishing.
And that led me to this wonderful, you know, scrappy, adventure-seeking group of linguists who have literally crisscrossed the globes in search of these remaining pockets of Aramaic speakers.
That's Ariel Sabar. His own father, Yona, happens to be from the same city as Esho, and he was the last Jewish boy to be bar mitzvahed there in Zaco, now an important and large border city. But most of the towns where Aramaic is spoken are far smaller, mountain hamlets or farming villages. For research on his piece in Smithsonian Magazine, Ariel interviewed five linguists, including a scholar at Tel Aviv University, Hezi Mutzafi.
Literally, he would get a phone call from, you know, Finland and someone saying, you know, a priest, an Assyrian priest saying, I've got a guy here who speaks this dialect that's never been documented. And Hezi would sort of drop everything, get on the first plane and go out there because he was worried this guy might not live another week. And Hezi described it to me as, and I said, you know, what is that thrill like? And he said, remember the scene in Jurassic Park where the scientists come across, you know, a living dinosaur.
War and migration have taken a heavy toll on the village cultures whose very isolation preserved Aramaic over the centuries. In the last decade alone, it's estimated that nearly half of all Christians who speak Aramaic have fled Iraq. In his piece, Ariel Sabar writes about the search for people from those villages who speak what linguists call a pure dialect. Surprisingly, perhaps, many are now living in the Chicago suburbs.
Typically elderly people who had spent their entire lives in sort of small, isolated villages, and whose dialects had not been diluted, either by, you know, moving to bigger cities where a bunch of different dialects would converge, or even had married someone from a different village.
Esho Joseph has lived in America now since 1991, and his own children don't speak Aramaic. And yet his cultural memories of his father, their grandfather, riding his horse through the fields, chanting the Song of Solomon each and every day of his life. Esho translated some of the song for us.
Ana wardet sharoni, baybunta dra'uliyata, khwatet baybunta gokitwe.
But for me, the most beautiful depiction of this language comes not from the Torah or the Bible, but from a folk song sung for many centuries in Zaco about its famous Roman-era bridge. It's called the Dalal Bridge, and the legend goes that the bridge builder's daughter-in-law, Nemo Dalali, had to be walled into the foundation to make the bridge stand. One day, back in 2003, Esho Joseph stood on the bridge and sang the song for me. There is some effort to preserve Aramaic today in northern Iraq. Schools do teach it, but linguists are right to scour the globe, searching for the last links to the oldest, purest form of an ancient spoken language. And it's time now for music. And not just any old musician. Today, we're talking to a godlike genius. Next week, guitarist Johnny Marr picks up the fabulously titled Godlike Genius Award at a ceremony hosted by the British music magazine NME. They'll honor a life spent largely in the shadows, off the stage left, supporting some of the biggest band leaders in rock history. Chrissy Hynde, David Byrne, and most famously, Morrissey. Together, those two founded one of the most influential British bands of the 1980s, the Smiths. The Smiths shone brightly through four albums, then collapsed in spectacular fashion, in a flurry of insults and lawsuits. Johnny Marr is about to do something he's rarely done in his esteemed career. He's releasing an album of his own, and his new solo work is called The Messenger. Johnny Marr says it's not really a true solo album because he's always got his band behind him.
I don't really know any other way of life. I'd say I'm a band animal because that's been my life from being 14. Back in those days, I was in a lot of different bands with nearly always much older people. I mean, I look back now and I think, wow, you know, I mean, some of the reprobates that I used to play guitar for. But it was a good apprenticeship for me.
Right. So it's time for you to kind of, if you will, control the narrative. That guitar of yours has been such a passport through so many lives and collaborations, and now it's your narrative. You're the lead singer. I want to quote something, Johnny, that you recently told the music site Stereo Gum.
Yeah.
And that is, quoting you back, "Everybody that I've played with over the years has been very strong-willed and has had a very strong sense of themselves, which is something that I'm very drawn to."
Well, there's got to be something in the fact that I seem to attract and be attracted to the very willful and what I think are fascinating people. All my friends and who have had strong full-time writing partnerships with Matt Johnson, mm-hmm. Isaac Brock from Modest Mouse, Morrissey, of course. I love them. They're very, very, very interesting people. You know, I did realise years and years ago that it must say something about me. You know, maybe I'm just good at containing some people, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, a good foil, but also you just said you pick some great collaborators. You know, you just mentioned the American band Modest Mouse. They
yeah.
had just scored a huge hit before you joined, and then all of a sudden you're in the band. How did that happen?
That happened because Isaac invited me primarily because he liked that I'd played with the Talking Heads.
Mm-hmm.
He tracked me down. We didn't know each other. And just consistent with what I used to do again as a teenager, I followed where I thought I would make some interesting music. But initially, it was just supposed to be an experiment. And the first night we got together in Portland, we started writing songs straight away. One of them was a song, Dashboard, which became the first single off the record.
Well, it would have been, could have been worse than you would ever know.
And I woke up, I don't know, 4:30 in the morning, like full of jet lag, you know, wide awake, mm-hmm. and thinking, wow, did we just write like two really great radio tracks, you know, within a few hours of meeting each other? I thought, oh, okay. You know, artists, I think, good artists know when they're on a roll and they recognize when lightning is striking, I think.
Well, part of the gift to know when you're in the groove, eh?
Yeah, it's a very fortunate thing. It's very lucky to have that inspiration and you know not to overanalyze it or mess with it and you just follow it if you love what you do.
I'm speaking with legendary guitarist Johnny Marr. His new solo album is called The Messenger. Johnny, there's a song here called Newtown Velocity.
Right.
And it goes, left home a mystery, leave school for poetry. Really, you're really great with lyrics. I say goodbye to them and me. And, you know, what I guess I am drawn to is that every one of these, I know that they're... that a writer is behind this, that there is a story
right.
behind this.
Thank you. Yeah, well, Newtown Velocity, it feels like a song quite close to me because there are only two songs on the record that are actually directly about me, and Newtown Velocity is one of them. I wrote directly about one summer's day, I decided just to not get on the bus to go to school and to leave school and not ever go back.
Left home a mystery. Leave school for poetry. I say goodbye to them and me. Mission velocity.
I persuaded my then girlfriend, who's now my wife, to also bunk off school. And it's about the feeling of the world, the occasional feeling that if you're lucky you get, that you can shape the world to your own destiny if you want, or your own command. This feeling that anything is possible, the future is yours, the world is in your hands. It's an incredible human moment. I got to live it out.
Johnny Marr, you are constantly besieged by fans and interviewers who are saying, hey, is there going to be a Smith reunion? And as I understand it, that is never going to happen. So have you been able to put your finger on this other feeling of why so many people want you to try and basically recreate the past like that? In a way that's a lot less creative than the past you just made come alive.
Yeah. Well, thank you for recognizing that. That's unusual, really. My experience tells me, unfortunately, that so many people ask the question about the Smiths reforming without really, really caring about the answer. They just really want to ask the question. It's a little bit like a journalist Tourette's. So in some ways, I don't look at it any deeper than that. But to be fair then to the people who do care, I'd like to see the thing that maybe it's because some people are nice enough to hope that there will be some big happy ending and it sort of plays into this nice story. Well, the fact is there is a happy ending. I'm happy and it's all cool. You know, it's slightly difficult when people assume that, well, your life would be complete or everybody's life would be complete if this band from 25 years ago reformed. Well, guess what? Life doesn't need that to happen for things to be okay, really, surely. My goodness. Go and see the Dalai Lama or something. That'll make you feel better. It's fine. Really, chill.
Johnny Marr, his new album is called The Messenger, and you can hear a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org. Johnny, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jackie. That was fun. Thank you.
For this week ending February 24th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Liz Baker, Amy Hell, Lily Percy, Acacia Squires, and Sarah Ventry. Our interns are Annie Russell and Rachel Rood. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Mathoni Maturi is senior editor. Steve Lichtai, our senior producer, and I'm Jackie Leiden. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station or stream it online. Thanks for tuning in.